It's August 5th, 2015, and welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. First up this hour, we'll hear about two upcoming events. Ann Murata from the Pacific Aviation Museum will tell us about the 8th annual Biggest Little Air Show next weekend. Then Jessica Grazoichin is here from the UH College of Engineering to fill us in on the 2nd annual Indigenous Knowledge in Engineering, or IKE, Symposium.
Finally, we'll talk about food sustainability with Kevin Vaccarello from Sustain Hawaii, Fred Lau from Mari's Gardens, and Marty Matlock from the University of Arkansas. From soilless farming to setting metrics, how will we measure success as we move forward?
And can Hawaii reduce its dependence on imported food? We'd, of course, love your questions and thoughts. Ready to call in or tweet after the break.
Now, we're going to first get into our upcoming news events that we've got here featured. And we want to welcome Ann Murata, and she's the Director of Marketing over at the Pacific Aviation Museum, and she's going to tell us about the 8th Biggest Little Air Show. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Oh, thanks, Bert. Hi. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, good to have you.
Good to see you guys. This is our 8th year. We're really excited. Last year, we had over 12,000 people that came out to our Biggest Little Air Show. So it happens on Saturday and Sunday. Next weekend, not this weekend, but next weekend.
What was that number again?
We had 12,000 people.
12,000.
12,000. You were one.
Yes.
Of 12,000.
And it was a fun event.
It was fun. We're going to recreate that again. We have keiki rides and games. We have, of course, fly-ins by the military. So there's lots of big helicopters flying in. We have flyovers with warbirds. And then we're flying with really, really nice big 1/5 scale RC planes. There's a lot of planes coming in from the mainland. So
okay,
we have
so
a
RC being?
Remote control. Okay. Remote. It's a remote control air show, but we do have the big planes flying over and land, and the helicopters landing the full scale also. So.
Well, yeah, I wanted to hear a little bit more about what makes it the little. I mean, it's a big, but it's little. So you said remote, radio-controlled aircraft, but they're not like little pigeon-sized either.
No, they're the size of this room.
Wow.
They're big. They're big. They're like 1/5 size of the regular aircraft.
Now, are these local hobbyists?
Well, we have Birds of Paradise air show team locally, Paradise Flyers Radio Control Club locally, Aloha State Radio Control locally, and then flying in from our favorite state of Florida, Ryan, is the Flyboys, and they bring in some major planes. So we have a big club from the mainland coming in.
You know, and what's kind of cool about this is that these planes are basically replicas or like you said, 1/5 size scaled models of the actual plane.
Exactly.
And the guys that are flying these, you know, remote control planes, I mean, they're flying them like they were pilots inside the plane.
Well, and the beauty of it is once they're airborne, you really can't tell the difference. You know, but scale is weird when it's up in the clouds
and it
looks so much like it. And they actually can do so many amazing things because they are remote control.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you're an aviation nut, what sort of planes are we talking about? Are these biplanes? Are they just classical propeller planes? Are there going to be any commercial jetliners?
We will have, basically, we fly warbirds, you know, the old 1940s warbirds, like the ones that attacked Port Pearl Harbor. We'll be flying a lot of warbirds. They'll be doing warbird dogfights in the air with a Zero and, say, a Dauntless. So that's kind of cool when you watch the dogfights. We'll be flying jets. We'll be flying helicopters. And, Ryan, you ask about drones. And I said there's always drones flying, so but they're usually the helicopters.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and then at noon when we fly from 10 to 12, and then at 12:15 we have everybody's favorite Kumu Kit candy bombings featuring Jelly Belly candies at 12:15 for the kids, and then we do it again at 3:30. So there's two candy drops each day, which the kids love.
So you're flying over with the RC aircraft, and it opens the bomb bay doors, and Jelly Bellies come out?
Jelly Bellies come out, which I don't know if you guys remember, that was Ronald Reagan's favorite candy. So Jelly Bellies providing these candies for us, and Kumu Kit is actually the company in town that's sponsoring the candy bombing. So we have two candy bombings a day. We have
no injuries from these.
No. They fly over, drop them out on the runway, and then the kids take off and hunt for them. It's
fantastic.
It's really cool. You see all the little keiki running on the. Well, it's not really the airfield, but it's like the field that the candy is dropped on, and it's like a little Easter egg hunt, but it's candies.
It's candies. Yeah. It's huge.
So this event is happening on Ford Island, and Ford Island is normally not accessible?
Normally, you have to get on the Fort Island shuttle to come out to visit us in the Missouri, but they have opened the gates so that the local folks and everybody can drive on that day. So we want to see people out there in their car. That's fun, because just coming into Fort Island is a treat if you can drive on. So that's kind of fun.
Now, from what I understand, there's other events in Pearl Harbor, for example, that kind of coincide with this. I had just read about the Nagaoka fireworks, which I think are Saturday night.
Yes.
But is that visible from your event?
Yes. And if you come later at our place, you know, say you come around 3 o'clock, you can't come across the bridge any later than probably 3. Because the Navy's going to be shutting it down. So come at 3 if you want to stay for the Nagaoka fireworks. You can eat. You can see. You can hear music at our place. And
what time does the Nagaoka fireworks?
They start at 8.
So you have to kind of hang out for.
Yeah, but we'll have food. We'll have a concert in 37. We'll have a lot of stuff going on. So if people come late and want to be there for the fireworks, they can also see. They can sit in the chalets outside. You know what the chalets look like.
And you said 37. That's Hangar 37. And the these hangars are huge, and they have their own museum planes already.
We do. Hangar 37. Hangar 79, which is that big, big one that you're talking about, the second, the one that's double the size, that one will be open for tours and all kinds of activities going on during the air show. So there's no charge to go in that as if you've bought a $5 ticket to the air show. 37 will be kept for regular admittance if you want to go in there. But for the evening, when we wait, having people hanging around waiting for the fireworks, they'll be able to go into 37 also.
Oh.
So there's lots of stuff going on from 10 o'clock in the morning it starts until after the fireworks are over on Saturday.
Yeah, I think Mauna Lua is one of the groups that will be playing live. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the regular-sized aircraft, the flyover warbirds. What do people see over Pearl Harbor?
Pacific Warbirds flies their steerman, and usually Hawaiian Air flies over their Red Belanca. So we have some really classic warbirds flying over at that noontime when we take a break from the air show. 12:45, the full-scale warbirds fly by.
That Red Belanca is the first Hawaiian Air plane, right? It's refurbished, and I think that's the actual one, right?
It's a beautiful thing. It really is. Yeah, they like to participate in our air show. We really appreciate that.
So this is your eighth annual event. What triggered it, and why does it continue? And what is the overall goal for it?
You know, our thing is always to raise awareness among the young people. You know, we're a teaching museum, and we want to keep the history of the aviation in the Pacific alive. So what better way to make people fall in love with aviation than to show them planes flying? So that's what we do.
And do you get a pretty good flow of traffic from the people that are visiting, like the Pearl Harbor Memorial, you know, the visitor center there? And, you know, I know they're bringing people over, but you know, you out on Fort Island, I mean, it makes it a little harder for people to get access.
Well, that's why we have the shuttle buses that run from down the visitor center. They run, you know, every 15 minutes all day, every day for 7 days a week. So we get the regular visitor from Waikiki that's just coming out to see Pearl Harbor. But then we also get the influx of the people that really want to get in their cars and bring their families and come on out and enjoy the big, big family day.
So how much are the tickets for this event?
You can go online to pacificaviationmuseum.org, which is our website, and buy tickets for $5, or for a family of six, $15.
Oh, okay.
And or you can buy them at the door, at the gate also.
Is there also, I think last year you had like VIP, if you want to pay a little extra to have
We have an amazing little thing going right now. People want, if you join the museum or upgrade your membership to a supporter level, you can get in like free tickets to the air show, free tickets to the VIP chalet. And it's, you know, $50 or $100, whatever. But it gets you in the whole year to all these events. Mm-hmm, become a member, and the air show is free, and the VIP chalet is free, and all the spiffs that go with being in the VIP chalet. And Bert knows about those.
And you're doing a great job over there, Anne. I mean, there's all kinds of events happening.
Yeah,
it's
a fun place to work. It's a fun place to be. We love sharing aviation with
now
folks.
Now, that tower has been completely refurbished now, or is it?
It looks good, Bert. It looks really good, but we still need about $3 to $5 million to do the interior. We want to. The interior is not done. We have merely stabilized it, painted it. And now we have to get all the windows replaced, and we have to get the elevator replaced that goes to the very top. And once we get all that done, we'll be able to take visitors up and show them all of Pearl Harbor.
And, of course, that was a big target, you know, on December 7th, 1941.
Well, that's where air raid Pearl Harbor, this is no drill,
right,
emanated from right in that tower.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of history there, and this biggest little air show again will be Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th. For more information, you can go to pacificaviationmuseum.org. And thank you very much for joining us
today.
Thank
you both. We really appreciate it. Aloha.
Now joining us here is Jessica Grzoichin from the UH College of Engineering to tell us about the Indigenous Knowledge for Engineering, or IKE, and their upcoming symposium. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Aloha. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this event is happening also next week, Saturday. And from what I gather from the website, there's a whole bunch of you that are going to be participating over at the Holmes Hall on campus. Now, tell us a little bit about this program.
Well, the IKE program stands for Indigenous Knowledge and Engineering. So what it focuses on is trying to build a nice pathway for students in the community colleges to set up a pre-engineering program and guide them from that transition from the community colleges into the big UH Manoa campus.
Mm-hmm.
So they could graduate with a bachelor's degree in engineering.
And Jessica, I mean, just we didn't get to say what year are you, and you're on the Manoa campus, right, in College of Engineering?
Yes. I'm at the Manoa campus as of now. Because of this great IKE program, I'm in the fourth stage of it, and it provides us with a summer course,
mm-hmm,
and a paid internship as well.
Did you start at a community college?
Yes, I started at KCC, Kapi'olani, mm-hmm, Community College, and I've also attended Honolulu Community College as well as Leeward Community College.
And what was it about IKE that helped guide you to now in your four-year program?
Well, they started by letting me know about an event held at Mari's Gardens,
mm-hmm,
where we got to go tour the gardens and see how their hydroponic system was designed. And later they let me know about this great summer program where they provide the funds for us to take courses or work in an internship based on our field of engineering we want to get into. And it helps us to meet professionals in the field as well and kind of see if we enjoy the work.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
So IKE, I guess, spans six campuses, and again, it kind of creates those engineering pathways. But it talks about Indigenous knowledge in engineering. So I'm curious, have you, although it might be early in your progress through the program, what have you seen as the specific contribution that Indigenous cultures or perspectives brings to the traditional engineering field of study?
Well, so we tried. An ideal student in engineering for the IKE program is Indigenous Hawaiians, but also underrepresented students. So that includes Pacific Islanders, and it also includes non-traditional students and women.
Mm-hmm.
And one community service event that we have completed so far was to go to a pineapple field in North Shore at Old Pineapple Field and learn about the land up there. And we got to camp and
got a little dirty probably.
Yes, really dirty. And just learn about the island itself and how we can make it better through engineering.
So I'm curious, in terms of Indigenous knowledge, has the program I guess along with introducing you to some of the camps and farming and things that are happening on the land, are there specific, let's say, knowledge that somebody, let's say, in Hawaiian studies might be having the interns or the participants kind of learn a little bit about Indigenous knowledge? I mean, could it be the cycles of the moon, or it could be, you know, agricultural practices, or it could be, you know, navigation under the stars. I mean, are there specific things that might be presented to the participants from a native standpoint?
I haven't been able to experience those things yet, but there are events that have been held, and there's possible events as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we do try to bridge the gap in the community and work with different local businesses that will have us and try to incorporate that into the program.
Well, I definitely like the integration of other businesses and organizations. You mentioned Mari's Garden. We're going to be talking with Fred later in this show. Your actual connection also comes through High Capacity, the local makerspace, correct?
Yes, it's a local hackerspace and makerspace. And it strives on building a community in the tech field. And not just tech, really. There's I think the we recently had the Hawaii Geek Meet.
Yes. And I've heard of that.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, how come I wasn't invited? No, I'm kidding.
And at the Hawaii Geek Meet, there was a cosplay table as well as a sustainability table. Mm-hmm. So, and tech, it can be involved in those things. So it allows you to meet professionals from all different areas and build a community and get involved.
Now, in your time at KCC, you had mentioned, like, for example, you're getting involved, the Engineers for Sustainable World Club, ESW. What's that?
Yes. So we're starting a new club. It started with a group of students just looking for a club for engineering in general, and KCC didn't have one. So one of our students, Jason Salseg, did his research and found a national organization called Engineers for a Sustainable World and thought that sounded perfect for out here. I mean, we have so many resources, be it wave technology and so much sun and that we can harness. So we decided to start this club, and we've already done a few projects. One's a rain garden. Another is a solar cart that powers cell phones on campus.
Oh, cool. Now, you know, in the last minute or so, I wanted to get you to kind of give us a sense of what is going to happen on Saturday next week. Now, you have 90 students all participating in this Saturday event over at Holmes Hall. I mean, is it going to be like a big science fair? Lay it out for us.
This is the final deal, and we're so excited about it. We're going to get to show off all the projects we've been working on all summer. So you're going to get to see an electric vehicle developed by mechanical engineer students. There's a hydraulics lab on campus where they're doing a wave energy study. Mm-hmm. There's also going to be a rocket demonstration, and also the Dean of Engineering is going to drink some desalinated water. So we'll put our skills to the test, and then you'll see my project on display. I'm going to talk about wearable tech and cosplay. I made some light up glasses with an Arduino. And I had a lot of help at High Cap.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
That.
So, and is there a website that people can go to? And this is a free event, right?
Yes, free event. There will be food.
Oh, well, now you got me.
Yeah. Breakfast and lunch. It is Saturday, August 15th, 8:30 to 1. And the website is hawaii.edu/ike, I-K-E.
Fantastic.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jessica, for joining us.
Thank you so much. Hope to see you there.
Yep, we will be. Of course, we'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be joined by Kevin Vaccarello and Fred Lau and Marty Matlock to talk about sustainability.
What new technology and what ways of measuring success will we see in Hawaii's sustainability future? Of course, we'd love your thoughts or questions as part of that conversation. You can give us a call at 941-3689 or toll free from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689.
And of course, we're live here in the studio, and you can tweet us your questions at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Aloha, Michael Titterton here. We're experimenting with a little on-air fundraiser on August 7th. We're calling it $5 Friday. The goal is to encourage 55 brand new members to join at the $5 a month level. Now, if giving $5 on a regular monthly basis feels just right for you, please let us hear from you on $5 Friday. It'll mean a lot to us.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Jacques Vallée, the author with Chris Obeck of Wonders in the Sky. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about unexplained aerial objects from antiquity to modern times.
Sunday morning at 11. Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Hawaii Supply.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today is Kevin Vaccarello from Sustain Hawaii, Fred Lau from Mari's Gardens, and Marty Matlock from the University of Arkansas, calling in all the way from Arkansas. And of course, Kevin is the executive director of Sustain Hawaii, a walk story for the healthy economy. Fred is also the founder and owner of Mari's Garden. It's an 18-acre organic and aquaponics farm over in Mililani.
And Marty, joining us by phone, is a professor of ecological engineering and has taught at the University of Arkansas Biological and Agricultural Engineering Department since 2001. He is also a keynote speaker at the upcoming Soilless Agriculture Conference.
And how will food sustainability advance in Hawaii? Of course, we love your questions and comments. And that number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu and 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome you all to Bite Marks Cafe.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yes, thank you.
And Marty, are you there too?
I am here.
All right. Sounds good. So, Kevin, I'll get this started with you. Maybe tell us a little bit about I know you've been involved with Sustain Hawaii for many years.
Yeah, 12 years already.
Yeah, and but when we talk about food sustainability, and of course we've always been tossing around these percentages. Like Hawaii imports close to 90% of its food. How do we become more food sustainable and food resilient in the event that perhaps that pipeline gets cut off, or we want to be able to survive more on producing our own food? So how does, what is the picture that we have today?
We happen to be contracted right now with the Department of Agriculture to put together a Hawaii food system metrics platform.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at very specifically what it would be like to address these numbers that people throw out, the 85, 90%.
Mm-hmm,
it's actually kind of a fuzzy number, and it's not super helpful at all for any kind of decision making.
Okay, so is there something more accurate that we could refer to?
Well, that's actually what we're building currently, and we're about to launch it within the next month. So what we're doing right now is we're basically trying to assess from existing public domain data, private data sets, importing all that data and looking at what types of foods are being imported, what types are locally grown, and disaggregating those food types into here specifically are the meats, here's the fruits, here's the vegetables, here's the grains, here's the dairy, that sort of thing, seafood, and actually showing how much percent of each of those when you drill down we're actually producing. Grains, nothing, but fruits and vegetables, pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts making the picture a lot more clear for policymakers in particular, and also for existing farmers who are looking for food import substitution opportunities.
Now, speaking as a couple of data geeks, where are you sourcing all of this data? I mean, like, let's say Costco's bringing in all this produce. Are you getting data from Costco or Safeways, the Foodlands, the Times? I mean, those are all private industries, and would they actually release some of that data to you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. The Costco's will be much more challenging. We have made some headway with Safeway, Foodland, and Times, interestingly enough. They're all receptive to the program. And the reason why we went down that path is because we were looking from in the entire supply chain. We're looking at the producers, we're looking at restaurateurs, we're looking at the supermarkets, the vendors, retailers, wholesalers, distributors, the full gamut, so that we can start really seeing and tracking where the food is coming from, where it's going to.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as we provide the data in aggregate so that we don't have any kind of privacy of information issues relative to specific entities, then we're okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, but some of the bigger data that we've been getting has been coming from military sources, airborne and waterborne sources. They track it all anyway that's coming into each of the ports. And then there's also some information that we're getting from USDA. They have tons and tons of data. And then private data is coming from Reference USA, which is a massive provider of data that like Google and those types of folks use in large aggregate portions. Mm-hmm. So we're using that as a data population at the outset so that people then can claim their own profiles because the data has already been pre-populated in that capacity.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kevin, it sounds like a very big project. It reminds me of course, the last maybe 5 or 6 years when we're talking more and more about energy sustainability.
Yeah.
And the first step was really to get a handle on where we actually were.
Right.
And you're talking about we have a lot of anecdotal stories. We have a lot of historical knowledge, how much the Hawaiian Islands could support in ancient Hawaiian times and what you can see based on just overall economic research. But you're getting into the weeds and you're finding all this information. So I think that's very valuable. I'm curious, are you looking also on the demand side for some of that information, like people reporting sales specifically, or is it more on the supply side that you're focusing?
We're actually really keen on getting information from consumer side, and that's why we started addressing the folks at Foodland, Safeway, and Times, because that represents about 52% of purchasing power for our food products. Restaurants are usually around the 48% in total, but it allows us to start kind of backcasting a little bit more so what the demand side is specifically.
Mm-hmm,
so yeah,
mm-hmm.
we're trying to address the whole supply chain from producer to consumer.
Oh, great, great. Now, Fred, you are the owner and operator of Mari's Gardens. And so tell us a little bit about Mari's Gardens and where do you sort of fit into this picture of sort of Hawaii's agricultural scene?
So like you said, we're an 18-acre farm over in Mililani. And we're centered right in the residential area, right at the very edge of the residential area. And we've been looking at food sustainability for Hawaii for the last 6 years, trying to farm in the metropolitan area rather than trying to take it out to the fringes of agricultural lands. And I think that just makes sense for the farmer mm-hmm. to be right there, right in the urban corridor. So that's what we've been doing. We're doing soilless agriculture. Most of it is aquaponic, but some of it is hydroponic. And our aquaponic site is organically certified. So we have been looking at ways to create a highly productive food system to grow plants on a very, very productive level so that we can intensify the amount of food coming out of a small square footage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how I live in Mililani, and I as even growing up there, I remember the farming area down there. I think I know you're kind of at the end, at the bottom where Safeway, past Safeway and such.
Yeah, the old Watanabe
right,
floral
right.
property.
I've never had the nerve to come and visit, but I think I will now.
You need to come by.
Now, you mentioned aquaponics and hydroponics and soilless farming, and we're going to talk a lot more about that in this show. But can you help us understand how that is part of sustainability? Because when you say soilless, because soil requires real estate, and real estate is very rare and in high demand in Honolulu. So when you're talking about aquaponics and hydroponics, how much potential does that have to alleviate that need for horizontal real estate?
We see a tremendous potential, of course. So we have been looking at buildings in Hong Kong and Beijing and looking at designing aquaponic systems on top of their roofs. We can put these things out in lava fields. We can put them on old parking lots. They can be built anywhere. You don't need prime agricultural land to be farming. Kevin did a system on his roof of his restaurant at one time. And I think those are the things that need to be looked at that will help make Hawaii sustainable. We're not saying that we're going to take over dirt farming and surpass the production of dirt farming. And we'll never be able to grow wheat or corn or grain, but we can certainly supplement. And so Kevin's matrix, food matrix, is going to be very interesting to us because what we're saying is, hey, let's produce all the lettuce that Hawaii consumes. Let's produce all the tomatoes. Let's pick and choose what we can grow, and let's do 100%.
Mm. So the you know, there I guess have been claimed that growing food on the land is so expensive in Hawaii that it's it's costing the farmers basically out of business because, you know, it's not profitable. Is that in fact true? And then is the model that you're describing where you get more production off basically any kind of land with a soilless system to have more higher yield on that sort of square footage than if you were to be growing it in dirt?
We think that the returns will be better for sure. Yes, it's challenging in Hawaii, but farming is challenging anywhere. Mm-hmm. And getting up to scale in Hawaii is the problem. Both ways, farming, getting our land base up to scale for agriculture is difficult, but our market is only 1.4 million people. So, you know, we don't have the trains and the planes and everything else to go and distribute everything that we grow.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be something where, you know, in the future we need to worry about. We need to think about exporting produce
mm-hmm.
at some point in time. And that's the goal. We want to get to be positive for export.
Now, Marty, again, thank you for joining us all the way from Arkansas. And we will talk a little bit in a bit about the Soilless Agriculture Conference coming up. But as you listen in, and of course, as you've been able to work with and interact with some of the practitioners and experts here in Honolulu, what's your broad perspective about Hawaii's prospects, versus what you're seeing perhaps in other states or even other regions of the world in terms of trying to find that balance and eventually maybe even getting positive and looking at exports and specific elements of produce, for example, that we can excel at producing?
Because of Hawaii's, thank you for having me here, by the way.
Sure.
Because of Hawaii's unique economic pressures and land pressures and latitude position, Hawaii has a wonderful opportunity to develop this technology that could be utilized in Arkansas, in Ethiopia, all around the world. What Fred nailed it. Fred described explicitly why this is so valuable. It's not that we're going to displace thousands of acres of soybean production in Brazil with this technology. No, what this technology, though, offers is the potential to produce very high-value crops, fruits and vegetables, with proteins, fish and mollusks in particular, for local, regional consumption and even export consumption. The efficiency effectiveness of this technology is incredibly promising. So that's why I'm engaged in working with the community in Hawaii to better understand how this technology can be advanced. Right now, it is an art. It's not yet even a science. Mm. It's an art because it is so difficult to put all the pieces together and manage them well. Fred is a master at this, but it takes years of experience and trial and failure to learn how to do this. We want to make this technology more resilient, more replicable, and more applicable at different locations. In the previous segment, you had Jessica on the line, and you asked her a very difficult question. What is it that indigenous people bring to the table for engineering that perhaps others don't? And I'm a Cherokee. I work with indigenous students at the University of Arkansas. They have difficulty answering that question, too, because how do you tell someone how you think about things differently than they do? I can tell you how. We understand that everything is connected, and we understand that those connections are incredibly powerful. And that's what makes this technology so promising.
Now, Marty, you're going to be one of the keynote speakers at a soilless agricultural conference coming up. Is this the first soilless conference? I know there, you know, we've had the others on the show talking about hydroponics and raising fish, you know, in sort of these integrated systems. But this is kind of the first time I'm hearing about a soilless conference. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think Fred's the host of this conference, and I'll let him speak to that. What I can tell you is that the interest in this technology, in this aquaponics technology, has just exploded around the world in the last 5 years, largely because of the demand for the valuable crops that can come from the and animal products that can come from these systems is expanding faster than our conventional production systems can meet them. And so that's why this is so powerful.
Well, you know, before I want to have Fred do this. We're talking to Kevin Vaccarello from Sustain Hawaii, Fred Lau from Maori's Gardens, and of course Marty Matlock from the University of Arkansas, and he's coming in for the Soilless Conference coming up. And of course, if you have a comment or question and want to learn a little bit about aquaponics and hydroponics, you can give us a call here. That number is 941-3689 on Oahu, or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Now, Fred, tell us a little about this conference. I mean, is this your brainchild? And, you know, this, I think this is the first one, but I know there have been others that have tried to promote the idea of aquaponics and hydroponics. What makes this conference special?
This is actually the first conference of its kind, in my opinion, in Hawaii for sure. It's because it's a culmination of what's in Fred's head and what my staff and I believe in as the direction of agriculture in Hawaii. So we're bringing in Dr. Matlock to speak about his sustainability matrix, because we believe in sustainable farming. We're bringing in Audrey Bentoncourt, the director of the California Water Alliance, to talk about what happened in California and why they don't have water and how many hundreds of thousands of acres are being laid fallow right now because possibly of management issues, as much as, of course, a drought that's been happening for three or four years. Mm-hmm. But 4 years ago, they had a lot of water come down. So that's part of the conference. We have the Department of Ag, Scott Enright speaking, his support for agriculture. We have Maria Gallo of CTAR, College of Tropical Agriculture at the University of Hawaii, speaking, how they're supporting agriculture in Hawaii. So we have the government entities. We have Dane Wicker for speaking for Donovan Dela Cruz, what our legislature is doing with the Galbraith property, and how the ADC, Agriculture Development Corporation, is promoting agriculture in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about soilless agriculture, but it's about the whole direction of agriculture in Hawaii. And then we have two speakers from Japan, the owner of Horimasa Corporation, Masaharu Hori, and Toshi Funaki, and both of them are multi-millionaires who are wanting to farm now in their latter years and use their technology to enter into farming. So it's a culmination of our travels and what we've learned over the years and how we can bring soilless agriculture to help promote agriculture here in Hawaii.
Well, we're definitely going to talk more about the conference itself coming up, I think, on the 15th. So, wow, you can go to the Pacific Aviation Museum, you can go to the symposium for EK, and you can go to this Soilless Agriculture Conference. But one thing I did want to ask Kevin about, when you're talking about building measures and how you would evaluate success, one of the things that Marty said was valuable crops, you know, and I can see two ways to measure that. Valuable crops in the sense that it's maybe it could serve as a protein source. It's high yield, low requirements of resources so that it can feed a community well for the amount of resources that it takes. That's value. But certainly another value would be what its economic value is, especially when you're talking about exports. How would you describe that difference, or is there not a difference when we're talking about determining a value of a sustainable crop?
Yeah, that's actually a really great question. We had to do extensive research prior to diving into the actual platform and the building thereof. We did global and local best practice research and trying to even, first of all, define what the problem set was and what there's a difference between food security, food self-sufficiency, food self-reliance, food sovereignty. What are each of those terms mean? And each of them actually has, from a more constrained from food security vantage point, all the way up to the most broad-based of food sovereignty. And then within that, a separate set of definitions which anchor that framework, which is you have the land and or natural resource base. What's the quantity of those that you're using? You've got the actual weight of the food production that's either being imported or locally grown. You've got the dollar value from the financial value. And then we actually started looking at what about the calories and the nutrients in particular. And from our vantage point for Hawaii, because it's the host culture is the native Hawaiian community, we felt food sovereignty was actually the appropriate framework because it starts looking and taking in the cultural values into context, starts looking at food deserts as issues. And then we needed to anchor the data into something that actually provides a real sensible set of meaning. And that's where the value question came in really strongly. So we specifically wanted to normalize the data, which means how do you define what the values are that become sensible to everybody?
Right, right.
And we specifically wanted to get at the nutrient side being the normalizer at the end game. Really
right,
hard
right.
to do, but the direction in which we're going to go. The low-hanging fruit, so to speak, is going to be the dollars and the weight
sure.
of the
so,
product.
So I want to get into a little bit more about that food metric, because if I, as a consumer, am going to be looking at a rating perhaps, and let's say I'm looking at a rating for kalo versus a rating for sweet potato, you know, what am I going to expect? So I want to hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Kevin Vaccarello from Sustain Hawaii, Fred Lau from Maury's Gardens, and of course, Marty Matlock calling in from the University of Arkansas.
How do we build momentum around this movement as well? And of course, you are welcome to call and share your thoughts or ask experts questions at 941-3689, or you can reach us from the neighbor islands at 877-941-3689. You are listening to Bite Marks Cafe.
Every weekday afternoon, take a pause after fresh air for a walk through a Hawaiian forest. Listen for the call of the palila bird, smell the scent of sandalwood, and watch out for that invasive fountain grass. Christopher Phillips hosts this 13-week HPR series, Mahalo Aina. We'll get a guided tour of the many benefits provided by our island forests and the work being done to protect and preserve these diverse ecosystems. Join him as we give back to the forest with HPR's Mahalo Aina.
I have always been a public radio listener. I like the different points of view that you get from public radio. Because there are two stations and I can always just flip back and forth, it just made it easier for me to just program those two stations in my radio. So that's what I do.
Member supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa. And we're talking to Kevin Vaccarello from Sustain Hawaii, Fred Lau from Maury's Gardens, and Marty Matlock from the University of Arkansas about food sustainability.
And of course, you can give us a call here. That number is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Right before the break, we're talking about looking at trying to come up with some metrics, some numbers, some things that we as consumers might be able to look at and make some determinations. Maybe, Kevin, can you start with just giving me an idea of what kind of a rating I might be looking forward to? And you know, when you get all this data and mash it all up and come up with a rating for, like I said, kalo versus like sweet potato, what can I expect?
So in our research, this particular program that we're doing with the Department of Agriculture isn't going to go to that extent where consumers actually have that. However, a conversation has been started because of the research done as a result of this project that has we unearthed a really, really promising tool. There's a set of academicians led by Dr. David Katz from Yale Preventive Healthcare. And they created a mechanism called the Overall Nutritional Quality Index. And that actually has a massive database of hundreds of thousands of products from the fresh produce to all of the prepackaged products as well. And each of those, they ended up creating an algorithm that helps define what the nutrient density of food types are in their entirety. So it's not really, it's like, so kale or kalo or ulu or whatever, any of those types of products, they will have a nutrient definition. From 0 to 100, very simple. 0 is junk, 100 is great.
Now, Marty, you also have been doing a lot of research and work in terms of developing metrics for sustainability. I mean, I think the question is always, are we talking about the same problem, as Kevin said, and I think Fred as well? Do we know what we're even measuring when we're saying that sustainability is working? So what have you been looking at in terms of metrics, in terms of measuring success?
there are a couple of framings we have to consider. First of all, my general philosophy that the consumer, the customer who consumes the food walking into the grocery store, should not have to make the decision about what is sustainable or not on the shelf, that everything on that shelf ought to be produced sustainably or shouldn't be on the shelf. So that's where we work with the retailers and the consumer packaged good companies and the growers to try to work upstream of the consumer just to ensure, to address that. I think Kevin's response in the ONQI that he was describing is an absolutely perfect approach for the consumer. We have to keep things simple for everybody because it's such a complex system that the complexity paralyzes us. So we approach this from the consumer perspective with three simple questions. Is it healthy for you? Is it healthy for the grower, the producer? And is it healthy for the planet? And now those three simple questions have huge complexity behind them, of course, but Kevin has alluded to that. We shouldn't eat things that are, even if they're healthy for us, that hurt the people who grow them or produce them or harvest them. We shouldn't eat things, even if they're healthy for us and produced well, that hurt the planet. Stop eating endangered species, for example. Or don't eat things that are produced in critical habitats that result in the destruction of critical habitats. So we're looking at those kind of metrics. But our overall approach, which I'll be talking about next week, is simply to provide a common framework for all of us to identify the things we care about, identify our goals for improving the things we care about, identify our common ways of measuring them and reporting them, and then developing strategies that we can share to make them better. It's a continuous improvement framework. It's something that our great-grandfathers understood. It is something that we need to communicate more clearly.
Absolutely. That's great. Now, if you have a comment or question, feel free to give us a call. That number here is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. We want to welcome Randy from Kauai. Thanks for calling. Welcome to Bite Marks Cafe.
All right, thanks. Can you hear me?
Sure,
absolutely.
Yes.
Great. This is awesome, you guys. I love the scientific approach. But from my opinion, sitting here on the west side of Kauai, driving right now, seeing all this land that is state-owned, that's all been leased out to the big chem ag companies, such as BASF and Pioneer and Syngenta, et cetera. My problem is that all these sustainable equations all lead to the one big lever, and that's the cost of land. Now, the state has the Agricultural Development Corporation. His charter is to promote sustainable agriculture that is, you know, grown here, sold here, eaten here. So assuming that they've got the ability to get the land into the hands of the people that are interested in producing quality products that are as sustainable as you just spoke, how do we get the ADC to get out of the pocket of all these large landholders and all these large chemical companies so that we can actually do something with our assets?
That's a good question. Thank you very much for the call. Now, I mean, Fred, you're an independent. You've probably made your own path, but certainly you are aware of the broader picture. Is there more that the policymakers and the government can be doing to work on these sustainable issues more locally, more independently?
I think there definitely is. And I think that the ADC is trying to move slowly in that direction. I know that they do lease a lot of the land to the Syngentas and the other guys. But over at the project in Whitmore, we're looking at Larry Jeffs is up there, Whole Farms is up there. They're spreading it out to some of the smaller farmers. So I'm not saying Larry is small, but I mean they're spreading it out to some of the smaller farmers in that area, and we'll see more locally grown produce. And if Senator De La Cruz has his way and he picks up more land, I think we'll see more and more small farmers, and I think that's a move toward agricultural sustainability.
No, and I think that's a good direction. But I think, you know, to Randy's point, I mean there's a lot of big money in some of the large farms and, you know, their ability to get large swaths of land. I mean, are we able to overcome that desire to appeal to those, you know, large corporate farming entities?
Well, keep in mind, what I always tell people is that we really need, we have a lot of agricultural land and it can be made available, but we really need to grow farmers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it's all fine and dandy to say, let's all go out and farm. But how many of us can really get out there, get in the dirt and farm? So one of our goals at Mari's Gardens is to bring children to the farm. We brought in 3,000 students last year, and we want them to look at farming in a different light. And so it's not just being in the dirt. It's actually soilless. Mm-hmm. The plants are at your waist instead of in the ground, so you don't have to bend over. And usually my first question to them is always, how many of you want to be a farmer? And usually there's dead silence in the room. And at the end, usually there's two or three, you know, that lift up their hands. So, I mean, that's the whole goal. Just turn some of them on. Let them know farming is a positive thing.
Absolutely. And I will say that someone that we had hired to do our yard work immediately connected with my youngest son, 10 years old, and set him up with a waist-high garden. And he's been working on that. We've had tomatoes. We've had the biggest eggplant I've ever seen. It took two meals to eat this eggplant. And it's amazing. And he loves it. And he also likes making Minecraft videos, so you don't have to be either or. Kevin, actually, this is a good question for you. Education as an aspect of this is key. Yeah. Immediately, I thought when you were talking about the military that in terms of consumers of food, the statewide Hawaii education system probably is another significant place where you could find data, probably, correct?
The statewide educational system?
Well, I mean, because they have to feed these thousands and thousands of kids. So.
Yeah, that is a good place to get some additional data for sure. And the military, from the airborne and waterborne,
right.
That is a subset of the data.
Are you able to get any data points from the Department of Agriculture? I mean, I would imagine they'd be collecting some information.
Well, that's what so USDA at federal level, there are some, but unfortunately, some of the funding was removed state level, and now we don't even have the folks that were doing the statisticians. So the Hawaii Agricultural Statistics Services, that's now been subsumed into the National Agricultural Statistics, and it's on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. So we kind of lost a little bit of that. And the intent of our platform is actually to help bring that back. I'll leave it at that.
Well, you know, so Marty, I want to get back to your sustainability matrix. You know, one of the things that I kind of heard you say is that, you know, if there's measures that you can assign to different kinds of crops that indicate that it's more sustainable in, let's say, an environment like Hawaii, you know, we could perhaps give them some ranking. But does that limit my choices? Can I still go and buy my dragon fruit if I want to? And, you know, or, you know, do I still have to, you know, just eat mangoes?
Absolutely, it does not limit those, because our goal is to create a knowledge system for producers to make better decisions, not to create a regulatory system to constrain decisions by producers. Our most innovative experimenters on the landscape in agriculture are the producers. The innovations that we will depend on over the next 100 years to produce the food we need on our planet without eating all other life will come from agricultural producers. We need more of them. That's an absolute challenge. Fred was prescient in that statement. The challenge is that the agricultural producers of the 21st century are going to have to be engineers, economists, ecologists, social scientists, political scientists. They're going to have to be all those things in order to succeed. And that is a very daunting task, and it's just hard work. It's risky, hard work. Some of us think it's the best work in the world, but recruiting those young minds to this work means we have to reframe agriculture not as that dull thing you do with a hoe in the field, but as the exciting, challenging, risky thing we do in the business and ecosystem arenas and in engineering and technology arenas, because those will be where the innovations come from.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make it very clear. Sustainable agriculture is not about limiting choices of producers. It's about giving producers more information, more data to make better choices for themselves.
Got
Excellent.
It.
Mark,
Kevin?
Yeah, I think, and Marty brings up a really interesting point, and one in which we've kind of been exploring heavily and have a lot of fascination in, especially the innovation side. I never had been in farming at all, got into it about 5 years ago, moved over to Waimanalo, ended up purchasing a restaurant as well. Doing some the agricultural statistics. So I kind of have been learning as I go. And it's a real interesting shift in lifestyle, and it's one that brings much greater meaning, and it's a visceral experiential thing, which I never really anticipated. Now I never even want to leave Nalo. I'm kind of surprised I'm sitting here in a studio right now.
Right. But don't leave. Got you. Stay.
No, but it, the thing that's excellent about it is we get to sit there and understand where different innovations can occur because we're actually controlling the supply chain in our case in a very, very, very small microcosm where we can actually close the waste streams from our restaurant and use those as feedstock for our farms. And in so doing, the margins start increasing. We're starting to do vertical integration. And there's a lot of different types of innovations that can occur as a result where we're creating healthier and healthier soils, which then help us create healthier plants, which then help us create healthier foods and tastier foods for our consumers in the restaurant. So it becomes a really fun approach, actually, because we're constantly learning, we're constantly tweaking, we're outside, we're experiencing the beauty of this place and why we're all here in the first place in paradise, and we're actually helping restore the ecosystems back to their original places that they were. And to bring it back to another point that Marty had with identifying indigenous knowledge and where the Ike concept comes in and what the benefits are. Seventh generation approach with indigenous wisdom from the Native American Indians is very similar to what the Native Hawaiians had with the moku management and ahupua'a management systems as well. So there's a lot that can be learned and harnessed from the Native practices and what they actually were able to produce here locally with a large population base and what we can now kind of reapply and integrate with modern day technologies.
Fantastic. Now, you know, and I like what Marty said and Fred said about engaging the next generation. You know, my kids, I like that they're aware, but sometimes they do come to me almost without hope. They're like, oh, climate change, brush fires, water running out in California, and our house in Mililani smelled like smoke for 2 days. And they sometimes, from their perspective, they're like, what? How are we going to solve these big problems? And I like that you're going into schools and working with students to give them the excitement about it, that there's hope there. But with the last minute that we have, Fred, one more time, if you can let people know how they can attend and learn all about this at your conference.
Yep. So you can visit our website, mariesgardensevents.com, and you can look at the flyer and go ahead and sign up, please. We want to fill those seats. So come on by.
And that'll be Saturday,
the 15th. So we'll definitely put that up on our show notes. Kevin Vaccarello is the executive director at Sustain Hawaii, and Fred Lau is the owner and operator of Mari's Gardens. And, of course, Marty Matlock is the professor over at University of Arkansas, and he's going to be the keynote speaker at the Soilist Conference. I want to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marty. We'll see you next week.
Looking forward to it.
Right on.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll find out about Project Imua, a collaborative rocket launch project.
And if you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And if you have any comments or suggestions, email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. And of course, you can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Bite Marks.
And please follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And we leave you with our song pick of the week. Here's a band playing at the Atherton this coming Saturday, the 8th, called Streetlight Cadence, and the song called Rooftops. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.
So small, and then the world stopped when I saw you. I was speechless for a minute, maybe two. Then my heart dropped. So what else could I do but shout it from the sidewalk, shout it from the street?